All right, the clerk will call the case.
Lucas, etc. versus River Hill Poultry and others. Richard Shapiro, Eric Washburn, appellant's counsel. Joshua Goad, Jason Whiting, appellee's counsel.
All right, Mr. Shapiro, you may begin.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Richard Shapiro, and I represent the widow, Crystal Lucas, the Lucas estate. I plan to address our positions in the same order outlined in our briefs, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. All four of the expert witnesses whose opinions the widow intended to offer were excluded before the trial below began. As for the medical examiner, her key conclusions were excluded. First, I'd like to go to assignment of error one, the exclusion of the medical examiner's report's key driver-passenger conclusions and the excluded live testimony from the medical examiner pathologist. No one on either side questions that Virginia's medical examiners are authorized to investigate the cause and manner of death under 32.1-283B. And 8.01-390.2 of the code, enacted in 2003, states that ME reports shall be received as evidence in civil cases. The trial court excluded the important central conclusions the ME reached.
But wasn't that statute enacted in order to deal with the question of how the medical examiner's evidence gets before the court, as opposed to whether or not the subject matter is admissible?
I don't agree with that. I believe that it means what it says, that the General Assembly intended that medical examiner's reports were to be received as evidence in civil cases, and one of the purposes, I believe, was to limit the personal appearances of the assistant medical examiners around the Commonwealth.
That's my point. That's precisely my point. If he was not there because he couldn't be there, and that report was offered, and it had inadmissible evidence that was proffered to the court, are you saying that the court couldn't remove or redact the report?
Well, I guess that's a central point here, Your Honor, and I would suggest, and I cited in our reply brief, the Beach Aircraft versus Rainey U.S. Supreme Court case, and I'll get back to that, that I think that if the report is within the mandate of the agency and that the report has the indicia of trustworthiness and reliability that the U.S. Supreme Court focused on, then the conclusion should be admissible. And that might include hearsay opinions. I think the General Assembly understood that medical examiners' reports, by their very nature, derive information from hearsay, hearsay from first responders, hearsay from the third-party lab reporting back on the results of the toxicology in nearly every report. So what River Hill says is the statute doesn't mean what it says, but there are no limitations in the statute. Nothing says except for hearsay. Nothing says conclusions are not included in what shall be received as evidence. So, but the trial court never stated any grounds to exclude the medical examiner conclusions either. So I think that's why River Hill felt compelled in their brief to cite Taylor versus Maritime, 1983 case of this court. But the problem, and they tried to bolster the trial court by saying that a government report under the Virginia Code at that time, which was 8.01390, that it would not have been acceptable even under the government report's exception in 1983. But the problem with that argument by River Hill is that that statute was a very narrow hearsay exception, and we adopted the Virginia Rules of Evidence in 2012, and we now have Rule 2:8038, and that was what was in effect when Mr. Lucas died. So our present VRE 8038 has a completely different hearsay exception than was considered by this court in Taylor. And now, under the 8038 exception in our code, unlike the statutory language in Taylor, if the source of the recorded information could testify if called, then that hearsay in the government report is admissible. So, but when Taylor was decided in 83 by this court, the reporting, the recording official is the language. The recording official had to have personal knowledge of all facts and events in the subject report. So what's a reasonable framework to interpret 390.2 in light of the different and more recently enacted 8038 government records exception? And I say the question is answered by the U.S. Supreme Court considering the government records exception that we now have adopted in Beach Aircraft versus Rainey. Rainey has been followed by at least 600 state and federal cases around the United States in the last 30 years since 1988. Now, the Rainey analysis is that conclusions and opinions in a government report based on a factual investigation within the mandate of that agency are normally admissible, citing the reliability and trustworthiness of government reports. Now, the language, Your Honor, trustworthy or reliable, doesn't appear anywhere in 8038. That was the framework that the U.S. Supreme Court adopted when analyzing the government records exception. So if the report falls within the government entity's mandate and the reliability and trustworthiness are not questioned, the conclusions are admissible. Here, the sources of the conclusions were available. The state police did testify in this case, and we sought to offer the expert forensic pathology testimony of the medical examiner, Dr. Ohanessian, as well. So we have outlined, we think it was error to redact the conclusions from the report based on the language of 390.2 and the framework or analysis that the U.S. Supreme Court adopted in Rainey. So I'd like to turn to the second error under assignment one, and that was...
Counsel, may I interrupt you for a second? Before you go to the next point, Professor Sinclair has opined on the subject, and he reads Virginia case law to suggest, and I quote him, under the heading Medical Examiner's Certificates, the statements as to the cause of death in these documents are mere expressions of opinion and as such are not admissible. That's his reading of Virginia law, may be right, may be wrong. How do you respond to that?
I don't think that's interpreting 8038 under the Virginia Rules of Evidence, because that rule, the government records exception, has been interpreted. I know we've only had the VRE 8038 since 2012, but this rule has been interpreted for 30 years, and under the federal rule equivalent we now have adopted, that I don't believe that's
so. But the law 803 is hearsay exceptions, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. So, but isn't that different from opinion versus fact? Because that's not the subject of 8038. 8038 is the ability to get in layered opinion, and all government documents are layered with it, implicitly or explicitly. But I think the question is, the ultimate conclusion here was the cause of death, and that's an opinion, isn't it? And the only thing I'm asking, I'm not trying to argue with you, is that distinction different from hearsay? Opinion versus fact, hearsay versus non-hearsay.
Under the Supreme Court's interpretation, I think partly it would apply to both hearsay and to the conclusions. I think what Rainey decided was it was hearsay, and some of it was the conclusions in the JAG report, and the Supreme Court said it was all admissible. And
unless it's a constitutional or federal issue, why do we have to follow that?
Well, Your Honor, I'm arguing.
Go ahead.
I'm only arguing the civil admissibility of 8038 for government reports exception here. There might be different in an overlay in a criminal case,
take the question as it's presented. Professor Sinclair has opined in his treatise about that rule, which is a civil rule, are you suggesting that a civil rule adopted in Virginia has to yield to the Supreme Court of the United States on the interpretation of a federal rule?
No, I'm saying that we have an equivalent, so it is an analytical framework that this court can consider, but we have, you know, our analog.
I understand that. Now what you're saying, which I didn't hear this before, is that it's an analytical framework, and it is, as far as you're concerned, it's very persuasive, but it's not compelling. We don't have to follow it.
Correct. That's my view of the situation, Your Honor.
Okay.
So I'm running a little behind here, so I'm going to have to rush through a few things. But the court then excluded the medical examiner from testifying in support of her conclusions. So this has nothing to do with Rule 803. This has nothing to do with 390.2. She is an expert witness and had the background in forensic pathology. We filed an EWD, an expert disclosure. We had a proposed deposition. The court still would not allow her to state the conclusions of the driver passenger. We cited a bunch of criminal cases that explored what a forensic pathologist, ME, can testify about. And the Locasio case, State versus Locasio, is highly persuasive because that was a criminal case. And New Jersey outlined what a forensic pathologist could address. And in very similar facts, although it was a criminal case, ruled that a pathologist could talk about who was the driver and who was the passenger in determining cause and manner of death. We don't think there was any provision of Virginia law that allowed the exclusion of that pathologist medical examiner from testifying. The arguments of Riverhill went to the weight of the testimony, and they also had the right to get a pathologist themselves on the defense side of the case. We think it was an abuse of discretion to exclude her. Now, I see I only have 3 minutes left, but I want to make one short comment about the PCP doctor. Dr. King testified about the sleep disorder that was diagnosed within the 90 days before this crash. And the driver, Mr. Hilliard, who we said was the driver, had a sleep disorder, failed to show up for a sleep overnight study that his PCP prescribed less than 90 days before this crash. The doctor was deposed. She was in California. The judge excluded every bit of that testimony, saying this testimony was too attenuated. We said this was great circumstantial evidence of our central theory. There was no basis to exclude that testimony. That was for the jury to decide the weight. And the judge refused the falling asleep at the wheel instruction, which was error. Now, assignment 3 was about the neurologist, Dr. Hansen, and the truck safety expert, Mr. Crawford. We don't think the judge had a right to exclude those witnesses. We had timely filed expert disclosures. The attacks the defendant raised went to the weight of the testimony, not to the admissibility. We asked the court to review a list of possible proposed opinions of the truck accident expert. The judge did not do that and excluded 100% of both of those witnesses. I'll reserve for rebuttal. Thank you.
1 minute, 32 seconds. Mr. Goad?
May it please the court. My name is Joshua Goad, and I represent Amy Good and Riverhill Poultry, who are the defendants below. In this unexplained accident case, with a single vehicle and both occupants are killed, and the identity of the driver is disputed, the appellant, plaintiff below, failed to understand what the jury's role was in evaluating the evidence. She thought to have her witnesses guess about Gerald Hilliard's sleep schedule and alertness based on medical records that were months old. She sought to have her witnesses draw inferences based on unfounded assumptions, as well as the marks, debris, and damage to the vehicles. And the trial court below correctly excluded this evidence because it was inadmissible. And I'll take each of the bits of evidence in turn, because some of the assignments of error cover more than one piece of evidence. So starting with the medical examiner's reports, she sought to have those reports introduced into evidence, the plaintiff did, because they included the state police's conclusions about who was driving the truck when it crashed. The trial court correctly held that these conclusions invaded the province of the jury because they were drawn from the marks, debris, and vehicle damage. And so they're inadmissible for that reason. Now, they're hearsay opinions because, as Dr. Ohanessian testified, she took her summary of the case, which is where the conclusions about who was driving and who was the passenger, she took those directly from the police. And she testified that had the police reported the other way, with Mr. Lucas as the driver and Mr. Hilliard as the passenger, she would have said okay, and that's what she would have put down. She, in her deposition, testified that at the time she did the examination of Gerald Hilliard's body, she did not have access to photographs of the scene. All she had was the report from the police and looking at the body itself. And she testified that she could not determine the position of the body based on what she had available to her.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. Am I right? When we're looking at 803.8, we're only looking at a hearsay exception. We're not looking at any other question. And when we're looking at opinion versus non-opinion, opinion versus fact, and we're looking at ultimate issue versus not, those are different from hearsay exceptions. Why isn't 2:803.8 enough to get the hearsay problem off the table for the plaintiff, putting aside the other issues?
Thank you for the question, Your Honor. The 803.8 gets rid of the first layer of hearsay. What it does not do is get rid of a second layer of hearsay or get rid of the objection based on conclusions that invade the province of the jury. So what we have from 803.8, if we were to apply it, would let the record itself come in, but not the inadmissible information within that record, not the double hearsay of the state police's conclusions that Dr. Ohanessian just transferred from the police report. Moving on to Dr. Ohanessian herself, again, her conclusions about who was driving and who was the passenger, she did not form those herself until a few days before her deposition. She was given photographs of the scene and of the truck by Mr. Shapiro, and at that time, she developed an opinion about who was driving, necessarily from the marks and debris and vehicle damage that she could see in those photographs. And the court, the trial court, correctly judged that that invaded the province of the jury because that's essentially accident reconstruction. And she also testified in her deposition that she did not have the expertise to draw final conclusions on vehicle accidents. Those were her words. And that her official duties ended the moment she decided that Gerald Hilliard had died from blunt force trauma to his head. She determined it was an accidental death. That was her role as a forensic medical examiner, and her role was concluded at that point. So her expertise did not extend to deciding who was the passenger, who was the driver. And even if it had, she would have been invading the province of the jury because she would have done its job by interpreting the evidence that's available to the jury. Dr. King, the primary care doctor, is the next piece of information. Dr. King examined Gerald Hilliard in November of 2016. The accident happened in middle of February 2017. Gerald Hilliard had been complaining of fatigue and insomnia, and so he was given an overnight oximetry test, which just tests the amount of oxygen in his blood as he sleeps. And Dr. King testified that it was not a very specific test, that it was limited to nighttime only, and her words were that you cannot extrapolate the results to daytime. And as a result of that test, he qualified for nighttime oxygen, and she recommended that he get a more detailed overnight test where he goes into a hospital and sleeps overnight at the hospital. There's no record that he ever received that information, and he, as far as we know, never went forward with the overnight sleep test. But that's the information that Dr. King had, is that 3 to 4 months before the accident, he was complaining of insomnia and fatigue, and he qualified for overnight oxygen. Now, that is the only piece of information that the trial court had available to it at the time it ruled on Dr. King's testimony. And based on that, the trial court correctly decided that there's no connection between 3 to 4 months before at nighttime to a morning vehicle accident. Nothing in Dr. King's records or opinion had anything to do with driving. Nothing in her records or opinion had anything to do even with daytime activity. And she testified in her deposition that she could not predict his sleep schedules and
Counsel,
knew nothing
this is
about.
Justice Kelsey again. Is my recollection of this case right that the trial judge said that pre-trial, but he flat out said, or she flat out said, it's without prejudice you raising this at trial. I'm not ruling on that. You need to bring it up then. Maybe new facts will appear. Am I right about that? And then was it raised at trial? And did the trial judge rule on that?
You are correct about the pretrial statement of the trial judge, which was, I am making this ruling based on the information I have now. It's not relevant, but without prejudice to bring it up at trial. Now, Dr. King's testimony was proffered before even opening statements at trial. So there was no opportunity for the trial judge to ever evaluate Dr. King's testimony after any evidence had come in. So at that point, when the trial judge ruled on Dr. King's testimony, all he had was the testimony itself. He didn't have any facts about the accident that had been put into evidence. And so all we have is a 90 plus day before the accident medical record about nighttime, and the trial judge correctly decided that it was not relevant because it was, in his words, too attenuated to an accident that happened in February of 2017. The next issues to discuss are the two hired experts, Dr. Hansen and Mr. Crawford. Now, Dr. Hansen is a neurologist. He testified he was not a sleep specialist, although he had some training. And he had myriad assumptions and generalizations that he had made about why his belief was that Mr. Hilliard had fallen asleep in the accident and while driving.
Counsel, may I ask you this? Is there anything in the record that would address the possibility of a heart attack, a stroke, a burst aneurysm, or something else? In other words, is there some forensic testing, autopsy, anything that would rule out those possibilities as opposed to sleep deprivation as impelling the disability of the driver, assuming he's the driver?
Your Honor, there was no testimony about whether he had had a stroke or an aneurysm. Dr. Hansen did posit those as possibilities, including low blood sugar. There was the only evidence that had to do with a heart attack is that Mr. Hilliard had a pacemaker, and there were no records that anyone could find that the pacemaker had issued any alert.
And my point is,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. My point is, if we're going to do a diagnosis that rules out other causes and backs us into the one remaining, it seems like there would need to be some way to rule out other logical possibilities for someone who's older, has a weight problem, seemingly has heart problems and other health problems.
Yes. And that is addressed in the appellee's brief, that Dr. Hansen testified that his diagnosis was one of elimination, and yet he went on to list half a dozen possibilities that he could not in fact eliminate, such as an aneurysm, a heart attack, low blood sugar, high blood sugar. And so his diagnosis of exclusion actually did not exclude many of the possibilities that he just did not count. And so he has ignored those variables and made assumptions that are not founded in developing his diagnosis. And in addition to his diagnosis with regard to sleep apnea, a part of his opinion was that the medications found in Mr. Hilliard's blood in the medical examination had induced him to become drowsier than he would have otherwise been. But Dr. Hansen agreed he didn't know how the concentrations had been derived. He agreed that the medications have long half-lives and could have been taken days before this accident, and he didn't know anything about the metabolism, so there was no way for him to know the actual effect of those medications. Yet, he assumed that they had had an effect, even though he didn't have the information necessary that he admitted he would have needed to draw that conclusion. And similarly with Mr. Crawford. Mr. Crawford is an accident reconstructionist based in Ohio. He came down and looked at the truck after it had been transported from the accident scene to a storage yard. And he drew some conclusions after looking at the damage to the truck. He drew conclusions after looking at photographs of the accident scene about how the drivers had, or how the driver had driven. He drew conclusions about how the truck had responded when it rolled off the road. He drew conclusions about what the bodies did inside the truck as it rolled over. And he just didn't have most of the information that he would need to draw those conclusions. And perhaps most egregiously, he had opined that Mr. Lucas had been pushed out of the passenger door because there was some damage to the passenger door. But in his deposition, he admitted he had never seen anybody test that. He'd never seen an accident where it had happened. And he didn't even know if Mr. Lucas could have fit through the opening, because Mr. Lucas was, as he admitted, close to a 99% percentile body weight and size male, although he didn't know exactly. He had just assumed that it was a 99th percentile male. So he didn't know if it could even happen, yet he decided that's what happened. Essentially, it's inadmissible accident reconstruction testimony that this court has rejected many, many times. And for those reasons, the trial court should be affirmed. And I thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Your time has expired. Mr. Shapiro, you have 1 minute and 32 seconds.
You're muted, sir.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to start at assignment of error 3, where Mr. Goh just left off. There's a fallacy among seminars in Virginia that truck or accident reconstruction evidence is always inadmissible, and hopefully this case could cure that. I'm going to call it accident investigation information. If this court reviews Appendix 89 through 91, the list of the proposed opinion of Mr. Crawford are set forth. The court refused to examine those for which were perfectly proper under science, physics, or other principles this court has stated. Dr. Hansen did rule out other medical conditions. His report is Appendix 15, and he addresses...
But how? On what basis?
The PCP testimony he reviewed. He did the best he could to rule out the other medical conditions. There was no defect in the pacemaker, and he had reviewed the PCP's testimony and arrived at his opinions. Now, who was the driver of this truck, I want to point out, was not the ultimate issue in this case. The ultimate issue is, was the driver negligent? But going back to assignment of error one, the pathologist should have been able to testify to her driver-passenger conclusions, and the lab results were inexplicably ruled out by the court also and should have been admissible. The exclusion of the PCP, Your Honor, the one thing I want to say is we had a chambers conference before this trial started. We asked the judge if he reconsidered his ruling on Dr. King. He told us he didn't. We walked out at the first break. Mr. Godin and I sat before the court reporter, and I proffered that testimony. The court clearly ruled that she was inadmissible.
All right, Mr. Shapiro, your time has expired. Thank you for your argument here today.
Thank you.
The clerk will bring over and the next lawyer and call the next case.